All right.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning to everyone. We will begin this morning with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning, I'm Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
I'm John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Our first case of the day is State versus Bershon. Counsel, good morning to you. Mr. Wilson, good morning. And Mr. Wiss, good morning. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
Questions? No, Your Honor, thank you.
Mr. Wilson, you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Paul Bershon. Your Honors, Mr. Bershon's raised three assignments of error in this matter. With the court's permission, I'd like to address the first of those assignments of error during this argument, at least initially. This first assignment of error relates to what I'll refer to as carbon copy counts. And the reason I call these carbon copy counts is that when you read these counts and the information and you read them in light of the evidence presented at trial, what you see are essentially undifferentiated counts other than what my arguments contend are arbitrary selection of calendar years to differentiate the counts. The problem with that approach is actually illustrated in a case called Valentine from the Sixth Circuit, and that's cited fairly heavily in my brief. And when you look at that case, what we run into is essentially a double jeopardy issue. And double jeopardy actually can be implicated within a trial, within a single trial. And that's one of the issues that Valentine addresses. Essentially, the testimony that was received by the court in this trial from the victim, BB, as to 17 of the 19 counts related to a general pattern of abuse. Now, the biggest problem with that testimony is that there was no incident specifically that was testified to other than an incident that was charged in, I believe it's counts 18 and 19 of the information. The remainder of these counts rely upon evidence that essentially consisted of of BB testifying that defendant, appellant, had sexual contact with her about anywhere between 10 and 100 times over the course of this 2006, the period from 2006 to 2017.
So if the evidence had shown a specific date in each of the calendar years, and BB testified it happened on this date in 2016 and this date on 2017, mm-hmm. would your argument be different?
It would be different, Your Honor.
So is this really an issue of proof?
It is. It's partly an issue of proof, but it's also an issue of, it's not so much an issue of proof as it is an issue of what consensus do we have from the jury as to each count that Mr. Bershon was convicted of. And that's the problem. Given the testimony we have and given the evidence we have in this case, there's no way of knowing what the consensus was as to any of those counts. Because, again, none of the evidence differentiated between any of those counts. And that's where the double jeopardy issue comes into play. Ultimately,
well, I beg your pardon. Why double jeopardy and why now?
Why now? So, Your Honor, why now? I'll address that first. Why now is because at this point we have the record from the trial. This type of double jeopardy violation is one which, and this is something that state and appellant, I believe, disagree on. They believe it's waived because this wasn't raised, you know, as most double jeopardy violations would be in a motion to quash the information. But in this instance, this is an exception to that rule because double jeopardy can arise within the same trial. And why now this double jeopardy violation arises within the same trial? Because the evidence did not differentiate between, we can't differentiate between any of those first 17 counts based on the evidence received at trial.
But you could have raised that issue with the trial court, could you not have?
The information, as it was worded and filed in the trial court, the amended information, after the initial motion to quash, which that's discussed in my brief, and there was but that was on different grounds. There were some counts eliminated. Later, there was a motion to quash, or there was an amended information, and it alleged these calendar year timeframes. At that point, Mr. Bershon had to enter a plea of guilty or file a motion to quash if he's going to file one. There, the information, the amended information, gave the appearance of the required specificity because it did list calendar year dates. But then, as the evidence came out at trial, that was displayed to be an arbitrary selection.
Could you not have, or could not, a lawyer for your client at that point in time, that was you or someone else, could they not have raised that at the conclusion of the state's evidence, for example?
If they had, I suppose that's, sure, a lawyer can raise anything at any time. I don't see, you know.
And if you didn't raise it,
mm-hmm.
Aren't our rules that you can't raise it for the first time here if you had the opportunity to raise it during the trial?
Well, I believe that in this case, had he raised it, we don't know what the trial court would have done, but I can tell you that we have case law from the United States Supreme Court that I'm relying on to show that a not guilty plea preserves this particular type of double jeopardy violation.
Let me ask you this. It seems to me amongst your arguments mm-hmm. that you're seeing defects in the information or amended information. This is something that would have been apparent at the trial level.
I believe after the evidence was introduced, that is when
you're saying you did not know that the information may have been defective until after there was evidence.
So the amended information charged these calendar year.
Well, they're like pairs, right? In mm-hmm. 2006, from January to December, first degree sexual assault. Next mm-hmm. count in 2006, from January 1 to December.
31.
Incest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're pairs. Would that have been sufficient if you'd only gone to trial on those two?
I don't believe the way the evidence shook out, there would need to be more specificity in the information as to time frames and then more specificity in the trial as to dates.
But haven't we, isn't it the general rule, and haven't we said that a stretch of time is sufficient clarity for the information?
Yes, initially. And that's the problem. So had he filed a motion to quash this amended information before trial, that he would have bumped into that case law. But during trial, the evidence demonstrated that these timeframes were arbitrary.
Isn't your argument really an attack upon the credibility of the evidence, sufficiency of the evidence as to these charges? Isn't that really what it boils down to at its heart? I agree it's artfully framed as a legal challenge, but in essence, aren't you arguing that as to this particular, whatever, pick out whichever one you want, as to this particular year, the evidence was not sufficient to allow a reasonable trier of fact to find beyond a reasonable doubt? Isn't that the heart of your argument?
It cuts both ways, though, because if you can't determine from the evidence what the conviction is for, then that's where we run into this double jeopardy issue. Well, so it's sufficiency of the evidence as a whole.
Doesn't the blanket bar rule cover that situation?
I have that in my brief, and I do want to address that. If I could reserve this last minute, I'll think about that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellant of the State of Nebraska. I will also start with and focus primarily on the due process claim. Rashawn claims that counts 1 through 17 violated the right to due process for two reasons. Number one, because the state's charges didn't afford him adequate notice to defend against the charges. And number two, because his convictions on those counts amount to a double jeopardy violation. As far as the first argument, the lack of notice argument, we maintain this claim's waived given that it was not raised below in any fashion. As noted in our brief, this court has repeatedly held that claims of this very nature are waived if they're not presented to the trial court. This wasn't raised, so we maintain it's waived and not properly before this court.
If we were to accept that proposition based on Reinhart, would we need to disapprove some other cases?
Well, Reinhart would go toward the double jeopardy argument, not the lack of notice argument.
Right.
But if you were to adhere to Reinhart, I guess I'm not sure you'd have to overrule. I'm not sure what you're referring to, that you'd have to overrule or disapprove of with respect to other cases.
Well, we have some cases or court of appeals cases which said with respect to double jeopardy, it's not waived you don't file your motion to quash.
Correct. I follow you. Yes,
I'm I jumped ahead. I beg your pardon. Two things you wanted to talk about, notice and double jeopardy, and I jumped into double jeopardy. I apologize.
You're good. I'm following. Yes, I do think, especially because the appellant has specifically pointed to a case in Martinez to suggest that these claims can't be waived. I do think case and Martinez are incorrect, but I went back and looked at Martinez again, and it doesn't cite anything for the notion that this double jeopardy claim can't be waived or wouldn't be waived. It does cite the Piskorski case from this court, but as the appellant has pointed out, it's not entirely clear what that citation meant. It might just be for the notion that we can look beyond the record to evaluate double jeopardy claims, but if that's the case, then Martinez doesn't cite anything for the notion that double jeopardy claims can't be waived.
It might have cited the U.S. Supreme Court cases at Bartell, but Bartell doesn't talk about waiver. It just says informations need to be good enough.
Right. Right. That's just the general principles that you have to provide
that
adequate
that
notice.
Doesn't address whether you waive this particular constitutional topic.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
So, yes, our position would be that if you are going to adhere to Reinhart and the fact that this is this double jeopardy claim is waived, yes, those cases should be disapproved of.
Right.
Just briefly, I guess, as far as the just last point I'd make on the waiver argument, as far as the appellant's argument that this claim is not waived because we need to look at the evidence in this case, that it's not just based on the pleadings. I don't think that's any different than the other cases I've cited in brief, especially Reinhart. I mean, the exact same circumstances would have been present there. He would have been looking at the essence of the offense as well as the evidence adduced at trial there, and that was found to be waived given that it wasn't presented below. So I don't see any distinction here between the claim that they're raising now and any of the claims that this court has found to be waived due to failure to present them to the trial court. So we do maintain.
What about this? If this court were to say, well, whether or not it's waived, it's unavailing. Would you go away happy?
if it's waived and also unavailing?
It's like we don't sort out this waived, not waived line of cases, but never whether or not it was waived it's unavailing. The due process is unavailing because the information is sufficient. That's how that would be reasoned.
I guess my preference would be, if you're asking what my preference is, would be for yes. both. And the reason I say that is from our perspective of how this shakes out in state court, in the event that we were going to win on one ground or either, it doesn't matter. But sometimes it does matter when we get to federal habeas, because a lot of times they're looking at rules and looking at it as a firmly established rule. And if we're pointing to, say, a waiver in one case and saying, well, okay, the court found it, the Supreme Court found it waived here, and then in another case, we just jump over a waiver where it clearly was waived, then defendants can come back and say, well, no, see, that's not a firmly established state rule, because, see, in these cases, yeah, they found it waived, but in these other ones, they didn't. And so in that perspective, if there's an argument, whether it's a waiver, whatever it is, whether it's procedural, even if it's less consequential, I'm always going to make it and adhere to it, because it can matter even over there. Well, it might not affect things here.
Okay, that's the outcome you see the state seeks, to say this was waived based on Reinhart, which was from 2012.
That's the state's position. And if the court were to go beyond that and say, nonetheless, even if it weren't waived, that it's nonetheless without merit, because this, the charging document was sufficient, provides a blanket bar, I have no problem with that. I mean, I think that makes sense, and I think it would make sense to reiterate that law, and especially in light of this appeal. And we do think it complies with State v. Martinez and the blanket bar here. The charges satisfy that requirement. There was a distinct beginning and end to each of the charges. And the overarching time frame of 2006 to 2018 aligned with the period of time during which Mr. Brashan lived with his family at the acreage in Blair, which is when all these offenses took place. So
does the state agree with the premise of my question to your opponent that what this really boils down to is a sufficiency of the evidence argument?
It reads that way to me. I grappled with it as I briefed this, because that's really how I was taking it, yet it was being raised as a double jeopardy claim. But to the extent we're talking about it in the context of sufficiency, and since that is their second overarching claim, I would note, or at least reiterate, that they aren't challenging the incest convictions. They're only challenging the sexual assault convictions and the three convictions for abuse of a vulnerable adult. And in that regard, I would also note, with respect to those convictions that they're challenging, that they haven't assigned and argued that the evidence was insufficient to find that the jury subjected the victim to sexual penetration during each of the years alleged in the time frame. They're only challenging that that the jury could have found sexual penetration occurred either without the victim's consent or that the victim lacked the ability to appraise the nature of her conduct.
But we don't need to know which one of those the jury preferred. Without consent based on either coercion or A, or B, unable to appreciate the activity.
Right. The jury didn't need to be unanimous on its verdict. Right. So either or both theories would have been sufficient. Right. But the point I was making in response to your question, Justice Castle, was that while this seems like a sufficiency argument, even in their sufficiency argument, that hasn't been the claim that's assigned and argued. To the extent they're challenging sufficiency, it's on the victim's mental state, not on was the evidence sufficient to establish sexual penetration or what exactly, which acts satisfied each particular charge, which is why I didn't respond to that in brief. I went solely with the issues that have been assigned and argued. With that said, I really have nothing else to add. If there are no further questions.
I beg your pardon, do you think that there's evidence as to each count?
Yes, I do believe there is evidence to each count. It's a follow-up question, is what is that evidence? The victim obviously had substantial mental impairments and difficulty recalling specific events and all the details of everything that occurred over this large time span. But there was evidence. I mean, she did say that it happened every year. She did say that he was the one that initiated. She did give an estimate, at least with sexual penetration, that it occurred as many as 100 times. She did say in her Project Harmony interview that it occurred almost daily. She said in her interview with the therapist after the fact that when asked how often this happened, she said more than once a week. So to the extent that the appellant is suggesting that there's just no evidence that this happened each and every year, that's not accurate. There was evidence to that effect. If there are no further questions, we would ask you from the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 4 to 6 seconds.
46 seconds. We'll give you a minute. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do have to take issue with just one aspect of the facts that I believe counsel for the state mentioned. She was asked, Beebe, whether appellant had sex with her, quote, every year from 2006 through 2018. She replied, I don't remember. And that's in the record. That's page 797 of the record. The state next asked her whether Rashawn had sex with her, quote, a lot, because it was trying to rehabilitate the testimony because it didn't have that. And she said it happened. Whether it happened a lot and if it happened between 10 and 100 times, to which Beebe responded, yes. Again, this is on page 797.
So at page 699, there was a question to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
You said it happened a lot, correct? Yes. Do you think it happened every year that you lived in that house, meaning the Blair house? Mm-hmm. She says yes.
Okay. All right. So it's possible that there's conflicting evidence on it. I just know that I had this right here in my notes, so I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention. Certainly, I wouldn't disparage counsel for the state. He might be referring then to that part of the testimony.
Thank you.
Yes. And so, response to the blanket bar. So the blanket bar, it works under certain circumstances, but not in all circumstances. And essentially, when you have a double jeopardy violation that could arise within the same trial, the blanket bar only bars future prosecutions. So my concern in this case is that you have the undifferentiated counts, you have testimony that doesn't differentiate between the counts, and then you have a jury finding him guilty of all counts. So within this trial, it's impossible to say what counts there's a consensus on. And from that flows the double jeopardy violation, at least in this case. And as I said, there's a case in the Sixth Circuit, Valentine, that I believe is pretty close to on point here.
The verdict form had a guilty or not guilty choice for each count, right?
It did. It did.
Not like it said, mm-hmm. Is he guilty on all of the counts?
Right.
It differentiated in that fashion.
That is fair, Your Honor. The verdict form did say that. Okay. But at this point, my time's up, so I appreciate Your Honor's time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State versus Vershawn. Counsel, you are excused, and the court will take up Jacob versus Nebraska Board of Parole. I don't believe there's anyone here on behalf of Mr. Jacob, but if there is,